Here it is.
From deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, from London, England, again, think of it, this edition of the broadcast, which, oddly enough, although it's originating in London, will be of special interest to our New Orleans listeners and to anybody who asks the question, how are things going down there these days? How are things doing? I'm pleased to welcome to the studio today a special in-studio guest, just flown over from Washington, I guess, for a relaxed weekend, Representative Joe Wilson of South Carolina. Welcome, sir. Hope you enjoy the broadcast.
Thank you. You suck.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, just a couple of notes at the beginning here. Maps provided by New York City's Department of Buildings show that coastal sections of Queens, Staten Island, and Brooklyn are special flood hazard areas. Why would anybody live in a place where that floods? Practically all of Coney Island, much of the Rockaways, the Long Island Sound, hugging strip of the Country Club neighborhood of the Bronx, and the southeast coast of Staten Island are all edged in the dotted blue that on the city's maps signifies susceptibility to major flooding. I don't want my tax dollars to go to help those people. God knows. Don't they know better than that?
You eat poodle duty.
Thank you, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, who's number one? A question we're asking on this broadcast now because of Americans' need, desire to be number one and to think we're number one, even when we're not. According to the CIA World Factbook, we are not number one in life expectancy. That would be Macau, followed by Andorra, Japan, Singapore, and San Marino. No, where does the United States fit on that list? Number 48 is Portugal. Number 49 is Wallace and Futuna. I didn't even know there was a Wallace and Futuna, but there is. It's not a comedy act. It's a nation. Number 51, Albania. Albania, ladies and gentlemen. And that means number 50. Coming right in at number 50, the good old U.S. of A. We are not number one.
You stink like hog bread.
Congressman Joe Wilson, who is here doing a fundraiser for the Republican Tourette's Association, and we wish you all good fortune with that, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, General Motors announced this week they are selling Opel, their German subsidiary, to a Canadian-based auto parts company called Magna, which has Russian financial involvement. That bodes well for everyone. And makes me wish that a song about the rapidly downsizing General Motors had just become available on iTunes this week, thanks to the host of Hello, Welcome to the Show. And it would sound something like this.
When you used to rule the streets and the track like a fuel-burning giant, you fought hard so your engines wouldn't be pollution compliant. You and your brother cars prospered by being defiant. And you had such big friends when Obama took the company away. You had a rotten winter, you're looking at a crappier summer. You're closing down Pontiac, looking hard to dump your Hummer. Bankruptcy buys, being owned by the fence is a bummer. But you had such big fun till Obama took the company away. Little GM. Chevy, you
gaskets are blown. Wheeling, dealing, we still gotta drive. Where we gonna work if you don't survive? And you're shutting down dealers, cleaning it out like a Swiffer. Going 62-0, maybe your mileage will differ. Clean in a hot rodder, going out of Blue Sniffer. But you had such big fun till Obama took the company away. Little GM shifting down to first. You were never the best. Never the worst. All that's left is a big fire sale. Little GM, you were too big not to fail.
This is Le Show, and as regular listeners to this broadcast know, I have an abiding interest in matters relating not just to New Orleans in general, but to the United States Army Corps of Engineers and its role in the protection, in quotes, of New Orleans, a role which it performed with a certain lack of aplomb in 2005, or we learned that in 2005, and now they're busy at work doing it right, supposedly. My guest today is somebody who would put a question mark at the end of that last sentence, a rare bird in American public life today. A real whistleblower, a former, I would have to say, I don't know whether you're still working for the Army Corps of Engineers or not.
I'm not former yet.
Okay. But you never know. Maria Garzino, welcome to the show. Thank you for being with me today.
Thank you, Harry. It's a pleasure to be here.
You are a Californian who found yourself in New Orleans at a certain point in time. Describe to me how that came to be.
Well, when Katrina hit, a call went out nationwide throughout the Corps for engineers to respond, mainly for the FEMA contracts that were going to be going out, but also for some of the rebuilding efforts and some of the emergency work that was initially ongoing. My district and myself, we put ourselves on an emergency wait list to go immediately. We were told at any time we could be called and deployed. It actually never occurred. It took me over, I think, 45 days to finally get in country, as we say. And it was only through a FEMA project, not through actual Army Corps. So I initially responded to New Orleans, to Louisiana, rather, to work on one of the FEMA contracts.
And you'd been with the Army Corps for how long at that point?
9 years.
And what kind of an engineer are you?
Well, I'm a little unusual for the Army Corps. I don't fit the norm. My undergraduate is in mechanical engineering. And I finished the coursework for a master's in environmental. My job title, however, is civil engineering. But as you know, most all engineers in the Army Corps are civil.
Well, until you rile them. and you are not a soldier. You're not a member of the Army. You're in the Army Corps of Engineers. But
oh, goodness, no.
Yeah,
yes.
Okay. So because that's confusing, I think, to a lot of us is that...
we're all civilians.
All civilians.
We're all civilians, basically. We're commanded by what we call a green suitor, and we do have some majors and other lieutenant colonels thrown in there. But for the most part, we're 99.9% all civilian.
And you don't salute?
No.
Okay. Now that we've got that out of the way, so you find yourself down in New Orleans, and at a certain point in time, you get involved with a project that a lot of us are familiar with. Mm-hmm. Listeners remember, there were three so-called outfall canals that poked their fingers deep into the heart of New Orleans from Lake Pontchartrain. And it was along those canals that levees and flood walls disastrously failed, flooding the heart of the city in 2005. And so the Army Corps was tasked to fix that situation. And so the idea that they were working on was to build gates to keep lake water from coming into these canals so that they wouldn't have to fix the walls of the canals, which had been so disastrously breached, right?
Well, that's not my background specifically, but from what I understand, the original plan was to restore the levee walls. And after they looked at it, they decided that that wasn't feasible. In the interim, they decided that the best solution would be to put gate enclosure structures at the mouth of those canals in order to prevent lake surge from entering into the city should another storm event happen. That would, in effect, pretty much take the levee walls out of play. And my part in this has to do with once you close those gated closure structures, you then are subject to the rainwater that begins to fill the city from the storm, and the city is pumping that rainwater into the canals. You have to have some way to take that water that they're putting into the canal and lift it up over the gates and back into the lake.
And that requires a pump.
Yes, it does.
Now it gets interesting because at some point in time, you felt that the pumps in these canals were not being tested appropriately. Is that correct?
Correct. When I first got to New Orleans, my understanding was two-pronged. I was brought in specifically to first oversee the testing that was going to take place at the contractor's testing facility in Deerfield Beach, Florida. And the second part of my mission was to, once these pumps supposedly finished testing and were shipped to New Orleans, I would oversee the installation of the pumps and the commissioning of them to bring them online. So I deployed down to Deerfield Beach to observe the testing that was going to take place. We basically follow whatever the contractor tells us is going to happen, and we just watch and observe.
And what did you see?
Well, pretty much every time we turned something on, something would fail in a way that was very unnatural. I had never seen anything quite like it. We had testing parameters set by the contract. And what occurred was when the contractor was trying to successfully meet those parameters, they were not able to because the equipment would fail in multiple ways. Either components on the drive unit would fail or the pump assembly itself would fail.
Were these pumps rejected or were they installed?
Well, it's not quite that simple. They were failing testing. And we originally had testing requirements which required that every pump be put in the water and run to generate what's called a performance curve. We were supposed to manually hook these pumps up to a dynamometer and generate that curve, but the contractor didn't have that piece of equipment, so they asked the Army Corps if they could put it in a testing tank and instead use that as the work that was going to occur and then generate the curve that way. And the Army Corps in New Orleans District agreed. So we went down and we observed the testing facility, and the first thing I noticed was this testing facility doesn't look like it can meet the what are called Hydraulic Institute standards for testing. So I had grave concerns that we wouldn't be able to meet the requirement, but was continually overridden by New Orleans District that the contractor was adamant that everything was fine and everything would work out fine. Well, we don't get involved in how the contractor does their work, so we just let them go about doing it and simply observe. So that's where we went from there. What we did observe was that, in fact, you really cannot perform a test the way the contract requires in that testing environment. But in addition to that, when we were trying to run testing and the contractor could not meet that requirement, they would ask for and receive lessened testing requirements, everything from number of data points taken down to it resolved itself to be finally, we're not even going to put a pump assembly in the water anymore.
The sort of thing that every student dreams of at the SAT time is, can we just make the test easier?
Yeah, it's like, here, can I get a pass on the last three quarters of the test? And you're going to give me the passing grade, and I'll just, here's the first quarter. I think three quarters of the pump assemblies never saw water. And the problem with that is pretty much almost half of the ones that did see water had catastrophic failures, O-ring failures, problems with the Rainier motors, et cetera, excessive vibrations that were. It's not just the failures that we were witnessing that was wrong. it was the response of the contractor to these failures that was wrong.
Which was?
It was when we had a failure, they simply pulled it up, pulled it out, put a new one in, and kept going.
Okay, who was the contractor?
Moving Water Industries, MWI.
And how many bidders were there for this contract?
Originally three, I believe. One was considered non-responsive. So two.
Okay, so there was a competitive bid for this. And I should say a couple things here to put this in context. And I mentioned on this broadcast a couple weeks ago that a couple of friends of mine in New Orleans or knowledgeable about this situation had sort of waved me a little bit away from this story. And one of the things they both said is, you know, the Army Corps was under extreme pressure to get these pumps installed at these canals. There was a deadline, I believe congressionally imposed deadline, of June 1st, the year after Katrina, to be ready for the following hurricane season so that the Army Corps could say, the hurricane season after Katrina, we are prepared for any such disaster. We've fixed it. And so everybody was working supposedly under great pressure and at great speed. These pumps ended up being installed at the canals, did they not?
Yes, they did.
And were they tested on site?
No, they were not.
I remember reading in the paper at the time that there were reports of vibrations coming from these pumps as people, I guess, started to put them into action. But
We actually saw vibrations at the testing tank. Also, when we installed pumps at Orleans, was one of the first canals to have the pumps installed and run. When I was there, when we turned them on in the field, we had vibrations then. I understand after I left and went home, they turned the pumps on at 17th Street, and they had to shut them down too due to vibrations also, yes.
So when you went home, what did you do then? How did you become a whistleblower?
Oh, you have to understand, it's a little bit more complicated than just that. When I was there, I was trying to explain to the New Orleans District Army Corps people that what we had were failures that were not normal. And we had a response from a contractor that was not appropriate on an engineering level. And we were actually at the end, I was only supposed to be in Deerfield Beach for 3 days at the most. I ended up staying there for 30. And I finally just left because when the New Orleans District Army Corps made the decision to ship pumps without testing, I said, I think I'm coming back to New Orleans because I'm no good here. Mm. Because all of my advice had been, the advice given, it's fine that it's not heated, but there was no point for me to be there anymore. So I came home. My job then was to install them. And I tried to explain to the leader of the pump team that we don't know whether or not we can turn these pumps on in the field and test them. That's an unknown because there was a design defect that the Army Corps unfortunately had built into the pump platform. It happens. It's normal. It's not unusual. It's not a bad thing necessarily. It happens. What happened was the pump platform drawings went to the site contractor with a certain pump elevation level, and the pump manufacturer got this level, pump on elevation, and they built that pump to that head. Well, they then went and changed the elevation for the pump platform without realizing the pump contract already went on the street. So now we have pumps that sit 2 feet further out of the water, which means you don't know if you can turn them on without damaging them, because you're not running them at design level anymore. And I tried to explain, we need to keep them in the testing tank in Deerfield Beach. But I was overridden on that. And they went to New Orleans and they tried to turn them on and we couldn't get them running. We also had Denison hydraulic pump failures. We had high pressure line failures again. We had overheating and we had failures with the pump assemblies themselves. So nothing changed. And we also had a problem where you actually had to wait for a storm event before you could run a pump, even for a limited amount of time. So you couldn't get a very long run time. The mechanical integrity of these pumps, which was already questionable, there was no way to test it. And there has not been a mechanical integrity test yet done.
Now, as I understand it, the Army Corps says that last year during Hurricanes Ike and Gustav, these pumps were run They make reassuring sounds about them as a result. You have a somewhat different view of what happened during Ike and Gustav, do you not?
Yes, I do. I think the term they use is battle-tested. Nothing could be further from the truth. It's a little bit confusing. After I came home to New Orleans, or came back to New Orleans, that was home because you end up living there,
mm-hmm.
I wrote a memo. I know what my job is as an engineer. I'm to report forward. And if I believe something is critical, in other words, I believe it's going to harm someone, I have a duty. And my duty is to report to my highest level in my chain, as far up as I can go, to the responsible authority, what I believe to be true. I wrote a memorandum, which I think people probably saw first, on May 4th, which reported defective pumping equipment being installed to the contracting officer. And for people that don't know, that's reporting it to a responsible authority means they have to do something with that information. They either have to ignore it or do something with it.
This would be 2006, correct?
Right.
And what do they do with it? Do they ignore it or do they take action?
I wanted to go back to your original question.
Okay. Army Corps says these are battle tested. They were mm-hmm. they got to work during Ike and Gustav, that they proved they're ready to protect New Orleans no matter what.
Well, I had done preliminary calculations in my first response to the DODIG. I was trying to figure out if they were telling the truth originally back in May when they said they had run pumps. And you realize when you run a pump at 100,000 gallons a minute and you say you run it for 2 hours, that equates to a particular volume of water that had to be in the canal.
Mm-hmm.
And I did the calculations and I said, gee, was God there with a big bucket throwing it in?
Mm.
It was like there was no rainfall. There was not enough water. I said, those statements don't ring true is an understatement. So what happened was there was a person here, a reporter here in Los Angeles, who had, through FOIA, gotten what's called SCADA data for the Ike and Gustav pump runs. It's like on the airplane, there's a black box.
Mm-hmm.
And if the airplane crashes, you go to the black box and it tells you everything you wanted to know to figure out how this accident happened. Well, the SCADA data does the exact same thing for the pump runs. So I was given the SCADA data for Ike and Gustav. And when I initially looked at it, I said, there's something really, really wrong here. And it took me quite a long time. And the SCADA data was also handed to the independent expert from the U.S. Office of Special Counsel, who also concurred. But we looked at it. And what I came up with was none of the hydraulic pumps were initially run to bring down canal water levels when they were at their highest, between 3 and 4 feet in some areas. And I think what some people may not know is there are direct drive pumps and there are hydraulic pumps installed. When I reported the hydraulic pumps defective, they had already put on the street for like 30 or 40 more hydraulic pumps, and they pulled the contract immediately. And they only gave 6. That's the additional 6 hydraulics that went to 17th Street. And then they reissued the contract for direct drive pumps, which they should have had in the beginning. So when Ike and Gustav hit, you had direct drive pumps and you had hydraulic pumps. They ran the direct drive pumps to bring the water levels down. They never once turned these hydraulic pumps on to bring that water level down to the 1.5 to 2 feet. And
the safe level.
Well, it was already at the safe level. What people should understand is you didn't even need to turn the pumps on. You didn't even need to turn to close the gates. I think there was only one gate that needed to that even remotely approached the safe water level. The hydraulic pumps themselves during both events were turned on and off and on and off, and they were never run at full speeds or pressures. In addition, the only pumps that really ran for any longer length of time were the 6 hydraulic pumps that were put in at 17th, where they corrected the design flaw and they actually submerged them 2 feet more in the water. So it would be, I think, fair to call it a straw man.
We'll continue this conversation moments from now on Le Show. But first, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Well, yes, we all know now, formerly obscure Representative Joe Wilson, Republican of South Carolina, he launched an apology tour, kind of, on Thursday for calling President Obama a liar in the president's nationally televised health care speech to Congress on Wednesday night. Obama accepted the apology. All involved quickly turned to raising money off the dispute. A possible contender for Representative Wilson's congressional seat next year issued a fundraising appeal Wednesday night, and the congressman himself responded in kind. It's Rob Miller, the possible opponent. He reported raising $200,000 just after the congressman stood up and said, "You lie." And he insisted that it was a spontaneous response, even though he had tweeted earlier on his Twitter account that he was going to go back to Washington and do something. Anyway, he apologized. He's sorry. We move on. In other legislative apologies, recently resigned Orange County, California Assemblyman Mike Duval is denying he had an extramarital affair a day after he resigned after he was caught on tape bragging about having kinky sex with a female lobbyist and another woman. On his website, he says, "I want to make it clear my decision to resign is in no way an admission I had an affair or affairs. My offense was engaging in inappropriate storytelling, and I regret my language and choice of words." He was caught on a hot mic on a state legislative video camera telling a colleague about sexual trysts involving spanking with two women, both married, both lobbyists in Sacramento. One works for a firm which represents utility companies, which he was on a committee that regulated. He's married with two adult children. He received 100% rating from a conservative advocacy group for his votes on pro-family legislation. He represented parts of Yorba Linda, Fullerton, Anaheim, Placentia, and Orange. He apologized for the comments that he was overheard making on his campaign website. Dateline Chicago, a religious publisher affiliated with the Archdiocese, has apologized for authoring a prayer that lavished praise on the late Ted Kennedy, whose views on abortion collided with those of the Roman Catholic Church. The publisher, Chicago-based Liturgy Training Publications, also ended up rewriting the prayer, made available for use at Sunday Mass following the senator's death. A number of Catholics howled about the language because Kennedy was a strong supporter of abortion rights. The church considers abortion a sin, if not worse. Another Orange County apology. Columnist Max Wicker of the Orange County Register has apologized for a column that clearly offended and outraged large portions of the newspaper's readership about J.C. Dugard. He apologized. "I'll try to earn back the trust of those customers in my future endeavors," he said. "I regret this incident and apologize to all concerned." And finally, here in London, British Prime Minister Gordon Brown has said he's sorry for the appalling way World War II codebreaker Alan Turing was treated because he was gay. He was prosecuted in 1952 for gross indecency after admitting a sexual relationship with a man. 2 years later, he killed himself. The Prime Minister, writing in the newspaper, the Daily Telegraph, said his treatment, of course, was utterly unfair. "I'm pleased to have the chance to say how deeply sorry I and we all are for what happened to him. Mr. Turing deserves recognition," said the Prime Minister, "for his contribution to humankind. You deserved so much better." The Apologies of the Week, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. This is LeShow, and we're continuing our conversation with Maria Garzino of the United States Army Corps of Engineers. Now, let's get to the point where you have gone up the chain of command. You have found that the response is not appropriate, and you gain the status of a whistleblower.
Well, the way that happened was when I was in New Orleans, I was trying to convince, when I came back in May of 2006, I was trying to convince people you have in your possession defective pumping equipment. And they said, no, we don't. Yes, you do. No, we don't. It took me over a month to finally convince someone, and we only did it. And you have to realize that I'm in the field. I barely have a computer that hooks up. I have to go into the Federal Reserve Bank to plug into a wall to get internet and email. And I'm working 16 to 18 hours a day. 7 days a week, and I'm trying with no books. I have no engineering books, and I can't find any anywhere. So I'm basically making measurements and giving schematics over to somebody who has access, and we finally come up with calculations for the inlet pressure at the Denison pump, and we prove that it's too low. And that is the root cause for why we were going through mountains of what I call mountains, volumes of Denison hydraulic pumps. They were failing. So I finally got permission to pull four and look inside. And when I did, they were shredded. And you have to understand, these pumps are meant to go for like thousands of hours, not three, and then be shredded. Mm. And so at that point, it took me, the effort to get to that level was so extreme that, and I felt there was a breakthrough. I still had hope that, I mean, I did not have the big picture that I do now. And what we did is we instituted a repair. We came up with that we can easily fix this problem of air being sucked into the Denison and destroying the Denison pump by retrofitting what's called a flooded suction. Raise the reservoir higher and just dump manually, let gravity dump the hydraulic fluid into the Denison so that you're not going to take the chance of air being entrained and being sucked in and destroying it. So I had worked, and the contracting officer had written a document. It's called a modification to a contract. It's actually an order from the contracting officer to go perform work. And I'd coordinated with the site contractors how they were going to get the work done. I stayed over in my deployment in order to coordinate this fix. I then proceeded to get on a plane and come home thinking I had done my duty. I'd solved this one problem. And I promptly find out that the day I left, they canceled all work.
They meaning the contractor or the Corps?
I have no clue. I think both. The work never got done. The only reason the work got done was when the internal technical review happened and outside engineers from the Army Corps said this is a life safety issue. And a year after, the general instituted get this work done. And a year, it took a year and a general for somebody to finally go in there and retrofit those drive units. And at that point, during that time, I did find out a few months after what had happened that the work was not being done. And I said, there's something really, really wrong here. And I started the process of what's called an internal. I went up my chain of command, and we started what's in the Army Corps is an internal review, and I was involved in that for about a year. So,
and what did you? What was the outcome of that internal review?
The outcome of the review. The problem with it was General Crear asked me to attend. I wasn't involved in the setting it up, in the initialization of it. I had no idea what they were investigating. I had no idea what they were reviewing. I was just on blind faith until I showed up for the final product in Vicksburg, Mississippi, and I'm looking down at the document, and I'm looking at it, and I'm saying, our job is to investigate these, I don't quite remember, but these five bullet points.
Mm-hmm.
And they had nothing to do with my concerns. A lot of good came out of the internal technical review because of my back and forth with the technical engineer, you know, the technical expert.
Mm-hmm.
We got a lot of good out of it. But it's just simply a step forward. It does not address the issues that I was trying to bring forward. And I found out later that it was the lawyer, division lawyer, that decided what points would be investigated, not the engineer.
So at that point, it was the Army Corps of Lawyers.
It seems that way. It doesn't seem appropriate. It would have been, in my view, if a report is entitled to address Maria Garzino's concerns, I would think you would
address Maria Garzino's concerns.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you might actually include me. Do these address your concerns? And that never happened.
Okay. You mentioned earlier some initials, the DODIG, which is the Department of Defense Inspector General. They got involved in this.
Well, they,
Go ahead.
Yes, they did. Got involved. They got involved mainly because at that point, after the internal technical review came out, I realized that we still had no way of knowing that these pumps would work if needed in a hurricane event. And I was, to say deeply disturbed doesn't quite go far enough. It was, at that point, not just a life issue, but we had wasted, in my view, that amount of time. We should have been working on a solution instead of playing this back and forth game. So what I decided to do was I went to the website, and there are two ways to proceed, and I consider both up my chain of command. One was to go to a higher level than the Army Corps, which would have been an IG of some kind, either an Army Corps IG, an Army IG, or a DOD IG. But there was another option out there that I was very drawn to for a specific reason. That was the Office of Special Counsel. And it was not for the whistleblower status at that time. It was that the Office of Special Counsel said, if you file with us, what will happen is this. We will look at your concerns. We will ask the IG to look into it. When the IG gives their report back, you, Ms. Garzino, will be able to review it and provide your comments in response. We, the United States Office of Special Counsel, will then look at your response, look at the DOD IG, and decide which of you is more credible. And if we think you're credible, we'll say, DOD IG or whatever IG, you didn't do your job. Go back and do it right.
So it's almost like an arbitrator in that.
It is. But it saves another year mm-hmm. of having to wait with pumps that aren't going to work if they're needed. And that's what I was after at the time. I was trying to avoid this cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And that at the time was to me the most expeditious way to get to a resolution that would be good.
Okay. So the Office of Special Counsel comes in. They bat it over to the IG of the Department of Defense. Yes?
They actually did. And it was they went to the highest level. They didn't go to the Army. They didn't go to the Army Corps. They went directly to the DOD, and that was very good. But then the DOD IG did a report, and I responded to it. I think my response was three times as thick as their report. It was, to say the least, a horrific example of investigatory effort, and I think I do a pretty good job of documenting that in my response. Office Special Counsel agreed with me. Everything came to an end at that point. They said, yes, we agree with Ms. Garzino. And if you read the 2008 analysis document, you can see a long laundry list of what they think is wrong and the wrongdoing and the problems and the likelihood that these pumps are not likely to work. At that point, what they do is they take their findings, they write it up, and they send it to the President of the United States and to Congress. And it's up to the President and it's up to Congress to do whatever they want with it.
So they sent it to, in 2008, President George W. Bush and Congress. And then why did it come back through the Office of Special Counsel again this year?
Well, it was very unusual, something that's... I think it's never happened. I'm not sure, but I think it was the Secretary of Defense said or issued a press release that said we do need to do more investigation into whether the pumps are adequately tested and to evaluate the likelihood that the pumps could be vulnerable to failure in mm-hmm. the event of a hurricane.
Mm-hmm.
He sent it back to the DOD IG, and they decided at that point they would hire an outside, quote, independent investigator to look into this.
And this was Parsons Engineering, yes?
Yes.
Which is a company that has a long history of doing contracting work for the Army Corps of Engineers.
Hundreds of billions of dollars worth.
They turn it over to Parsons. Parsons does what?
Well, they put together a report that I think that falls short on a grand scale.
What happened when Parsons submitted its report?
Well, this was what was very interesting and what was really wonderful about this whole process at this point. Because of all of this back and forth and all of the lack of truly addressing the issue and trying to resolve it and trying to come up with real answers, The OSC decided that they themselves would go out and independently contract with their own outside technical expert in this field. They did it very quietly, and his job was to review all of the previous investigations, all of my responses, all of the technical information, which there's mountains of it, that I provided for the pumps, videotape, photographs, notes. And his job was to look at that. And then when the Parsons report came in, I was to do my response document to it, which I did. It's about 100, I don't know. It's very long and detailed and very explicit. And his job was to look at my response also, not just the Parsons report, but my response to it, and to provide back to the Office of Special Counsel his determination and findings.
And his conclusion?
I was completely validated on all points, except I think one was not applicable.
And based on that report from their own expert, the Office of Special Counsel, and this is what I first saw in May or June of this year, you sent me the documents in which the Office of Special Counsel now remanded, to use a police term, the issue, having decided that your criticisms were vindicated, back to the president and to Congress. Is that correct? And now it's going to President Obama and Democratic Congress. And that was in June. Has there been any response from either the White House or Congress, to your knowledge, up to this point?
No, there's been no official response yet.
And you still work for the Army Corps?
Yes, I do.
And what's that been like? You've been basically battling the Army Corps for the last 2-3 years judging by your own story, on a pretty dogged basis, and yet you go to work there every day.
Oh, absolutely. It's doing my job. It's not battling. It's doing my job. There's nothing adversarial about it at all. It shouldn't be. It's also outside of my district, so it's not as if it's something that I walk in every day and look at and address the very people that I'm redressing in my documents. Mm-hmm. So it's very different.
But you've not been subjected to any negative treatment as a result of this experience so far?
Well, no, that's not quite true.
Okay.
Yeah.
Correct me.
Yeah, well, I believe the term marginalized would apply.
Got it. Okay. In terms of what you're allowed to do in terms of your professional involvement?
Yes.
Okay. There's a fairly well-known whistleblower who came up against the Army Corps of Engineers in terms of their contracting practices in Iraq, a woman by the name of Bunatine Greenhouse. How would you compare your experience as a whistleblower vis-a-vis the Army Corps with hers? Or are you familiar with her case?
I am, but I think we're very different on many levels, but maybe similar when it comes to marginalized. I believe they demoted her, however, and I think, for lack of a better term, I don't know if she had any work assigned.
Wow.
But I don't know. She is a very high-level person. It would be two very different types of entities, really.
Okay. You said earlier there was a point where you didn't know the big picture that you do know now. What's the big picture?
I hope it's understood how really very proud I am to be an engineer working for the Corps, and how proud I am of my career, and including now, what I'm doing now. I think that as a Californian who responded to New Orleans, it was a privilege and an honor to be down there trying to do work, especially given the circumstances. We had an opportunity, we have an opportunity in front of us to repair what we ourselves have done wrong. And to do that, it's critical to get it right for many reasons. And I think that's what has been the largest driving factor for me.
Okay, let me ask you, based on your working with people down there on this project, you said get right what we did wrong. Do you think that the people in the Army Corps in New Orleans believe what two independent forensic engineering reports said and what the Corps' own report said, that it was something they did wrong that precipitated the flooding?
I'm sure they would. Our general stood up and took responsibility. Well, I don't know why they wouldn't. If your commander stands up and says so, I don't see any other reason not to.
Okay. The Corps, in a story about this that was published earlier this week in the New Orleans Times-Picayune, which gives considerable space to the response of the Corps, or the Corps spokesperson in New Orleans, she says, referring to you, Maria Garzina hasn't been here on site with these pumps in quite a while. And we're here every day.
Well, she's right physically, I mean technically, but not correct as far as the overall picture goes. I've been involved, not just from the time I was physically there, but during the entire technical review process and subsequent to that in every investigation in detail. In addition, I've been involved in follow-on acceptance testing records, compilations, SCADA data. I think overall it's a means maybe to marginalize what I have to say.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that I've got this right, but in some of the reports I was reading about this, I seem to remember that there was at least a point in time when these pumps were supposed to be a part of the permanent solution, is that right? And then they were then declared temporary. Tell me about that.
Well, when I showed up in New Orleans, I looked at the structures that they were building. They were monoliths. And I looked at the pumps and the different costs. And this was interim. The capacity was interim at that time. We could only put in so much. And I said the name of the contract was temporary. I said, do you mean these things are temporary? And the head of the pump team said, no, the capacity is what's temporary. We have limited ability in what we can put in to meet our June 1st deadline. But I noticed something that when I came back and said these hydraulic pumps are defective, and as we went forward and it was discovered more and more, they are, and as the investigations went forward, there became this tendency from, no, the pumps are permanent and they're going to be part of the permanent solution. They're going to be incorporated to, no, we're going to get rid of them. They're only supposed to be there 5 years. There was this shift that happened. And that was very disturbing, but that was the intent. And if you go back and look at the congressional documents, and if you go back and look at the laws, the PL 109-234, 110-252, and if you go back and look at what are called project information reports, that's where you really see the intent. And project information reports are documents that are put together in an emergency situation like this was by the Army Corps in the field, the New Orleans District. And what they do is this. They kind of, it's a format they have to follow, and it has to be signed off and formally signed off by everybody. And it's sent forward headquarters, and then Congress sees this. And in there, they say, Congress, it's kind of like saying to Congress, here's the project we have, a concept, and this is what we'd like to do, and this is how much it's going to cost. And in the economic analysis, they use a 50-year lifespan, and they come up with a 7.3-to-1 benefit-to-cost ratio to justify the project. In other words, that will justify, here, Congress, this has a positive, a very good benefit-to-cost ratio, therefore you'll want to give me money. And
so Congress, in approving this project, believed they were building something with a 50-year lifespan?
Yes.
And the lifespan now is?
Well, 5 years. And if you do that, you actually end up with a less than one benefit-to-cost ratio, which means you're losing money. You were better off doing nothing.
And how much did these pumps cost?
Well, the pumps themselves are not that expensive in the realm, in the total picture. I think maybe in total, maybe $40 million for everything or something like that. But what is important, you have to put those pumps on something. You have to put those drive units on something. And those pump platforms and those drive unit platforms and the piping and all the work that goes into it and incorporating it into the closure structure, it costs hundreds of millions of dollars to do that.
And so we're going to have to spend more hundreds of millions of dollars to replace them.
Well, there's a report. It's dated April 27th, 2009. It was actually done by the Army Corps, but it was started a couple years ago. And it actually analyzes that very thing. And it looks at it and it says, how do we turn these interim closure structure, gate interim closure structures with installed pumps into a 50-year lifespan? And they say very clearly in that report, well, first you keep all the direct drives, keep them, but you have to take out all the hydraulic pumps and all the structures and replace them with direct drives.
At a cost of, do we know? Did they estimate?
Yeah, about $270
million. Maria, I want to, as we come near the close, I want to sort of focus on two questions.
Sure.
One is that there are these direct drive pumps, which I guess you and the Corps and everyone who's looked at this agree do work.
Oh, they work wonderfully. The Patterson pumps work great, and so do the Fairbanks Morrissey.
And so is there enough of them in each of these locations on these three outfall canals to assure New Orleanians that in the event of a major storm surge incident, they are protected by this temporary setup?
Goodness, no.
Okay.
Absolutely not.
All right.
No.
That the missing piece is these hydraulic pumps, which you believe are not reliable.
One of the things that the Office of Special Counsel's expert came up with was he said very clearly, while the issues I brought forward are correct and they're valid, he said, I actually didn't go far enough. And the findings of what is wrong engineering-wise with these pumps is extraordinary. The design defects are significant. The report itself goes into great detail explaining them, what is wrong. And the backup documents, those limited backup documents from the acceptance testing even back it all up with failures noted in the field for Durst drives. And we know that when you turn these things on, there's no reasonable way to ever believe that they will run during an actual hurricane event due to these design defects.
The other question is, given what you've discovered in your, let's call it, your journey, how safe do you think New Orleanians should feel tonight knowing that these are the people who are controlling their safety in the case of a hurricane event? That may be above your pay grade, but I'm throwing it at you just in case.
Well, I would respectfully disagree with Brigadier General. I would say this. I would respectfully disagree with Brigadier General Walsh's op-ed that was run in the Times-Picayune. Jesslyn Radak and myself wrote a rebuttal to that very thing. I think in his op-ed he was trying to reassure New Orleanians that everything worked right and to implore them to let the Corps build what was called Option 1. But the rebuttal that Jesslyn Radak and myself came up with, I think it would have been a very good answer to that question. However, they refused to run it.
The paper did.
Yeah.
If you had this to do all over again, would you do what you've done?
Well, I think I'd have to. It's something that, as an engineer, you have to do. And it's something also, I think, being an engineer working for the federal government becomes even more important that people be able to do this very thing. So, yes, I would have to do that.
Okay. And one final question, and it's a more emotional one than any of these others, I guess.
Okay.
People in New Orleans have gotten used to, if not inured to, as part of the defense of anything that the Corps does that gets criticized, the statement by people at the Corps, we live here too.
Yeah.
What do you say to that?
Are they really vested in the same way? I don't think so in the same way. Are they really living the way the average individual has to survive? I don't know. A lot of people are. There were a lot of Army Corps people that were very hurt by the storm event. But in essence, we live there too, I think minimizes what a lot of other people are going through and have gone through, especially when you're transplanted.
Mm-hmm. Maria Garzino of the United States Army Corps of Engineers, who I'm sure you are speaking today in your personal capacity and not as a representative of the Corps.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I know this was not easy for you, and I really appreciate you spending the time with me today.
Thank you, Harry.
And one thing more, ladies and gentlemen, news from Inspectors General, the U.S. Internal Revenue Service is struggling with an aging workforce where more than a third of the executives are eligible for retirement, a scenario that puts its mission at risk. According to the Treasury Department's Inspector General, the IRS faces a loss of leadership and technical employees that it could threaten its ability to provide American taxpayers the service they've come to expect, unquote. From the IRS. That concludes this week's edition of Le Show. The service you expect from this broadcast will return next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz shortwave, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internets, at two different locations, live and archive whenever you want, at harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available on your smartphone via stitcher.com. Available as a free download for members at audible.com. And available as a free podcast from kcrw.com. And it'd be just like the pumps working if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much. Tip of the Le Show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks. Thanks to Ian at Silk Studios in London. Ian and Greg, as a matter of fact, and the gang at Buzzy's Sound in Los Angeles for helping to make today's broadcast possible. The email address for this broadcast and information on the music heard hereon are always just part of the package at harryshearer.com. And yes, little GM is the first of the digital releases from Greed and Fear at iTunes and Amazon. And thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. So long from London.